you very much. About one third of St. Mark's Gospel is taken up with the events of the last week of Jesus' life. It's a very striking proportion. It's led to some people describing St. Mark as a passion narrative with a long introduction. By comparison, about one-seventh of St. Matthew and St. Luke is taken up with the comparable period. So it's very clear that as we move into St. Mark's narrative of the last days of Jesus' life on earth, we're moving into a slightly different atmosphere. The narrative, which up to this point has been rushed and packed and a bit scattergun in its approach, slows down very discernibly. There are rather more references to the Old Testament, and there are a lot more references to specific places in and around Jerusalem. It's often been noted that St. Mark's geography in the rest of the Gospel is a little bit slapdash. He doesn't, for example, seem absolutely sure whether Tyre is north of Sidon or south. But as a recent commentator quite aptly remarked, if we were asked cold whether Manchester was north of Liverpool, a lot of us might have similar problems. But in contrast to the rather general feel of the rest of Mark's Gospel, in terms of location, there's no doubt at all that when he turns to this final period, he has a very, very specific set of locations in view. If you read the last couple of chapters, you'll notice that they fall into episodes at particular places. The upper room, Gethsemane, the high priest's residence, the governor's residence, the way to Calvary, Calvary itself, and the tomb. And that has suggested to some readers a theory which seems to me extremely credible, which is that the kernel of this narrative began as a kind of liturgy in Jerusalem, something like the Stations of the Cross. That is, the early community in Jerusalem would walk the path of Jesus, and at each point, each geographical point in the city, there would be a narrative with some Old Testament reference and some prayers, concluding, no doubt, at the tomb with the words, "He is not here, he is risen." I think I must say that that makes very good sense of the way in which the story is told. And it certainly gives a very firm basis to the idea that Mark, Matthew, and Luke are all together here, depending not just on the words of the earliest community, but on a practice of prayer and devotion as well, with readings and stories at these particular points. Those of you who know the old city in Jerusalem will know that these sites are, of course, quite close together, and you can indeed do them inside of a morning. So perhaps, a tempting possibility, perhaps when we read the last chapters of Mark, we are sharing just a little bit of the worship of the very first communities in the Holy City. I'll come back to the question of Mark's use of Jewish scripture in this portion of his gospel, and indeed throughout. But first, I want to underline one of the governing themes of the way Mark tells the story of these last days. You could say that the effect of how he tells the story is to isolate Jesus more and more. He is left increasingly alone. The disciples forsake him. Peter betrays him. The high priestly council condemns him. The Roman governor and the soldiers reject and abuse him. And he ends on the cross with God apparently abandoning him. The last recorded words of Jesus in Mark are, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" And the intensity of that progression in the last pages of Mark is again something of great significance in understanding what he's getting at in the whole gospel. Our attention is focused, you might say, mercilessly on this one figure. The one figure who has to carry the whole meaning, the whole theological, spiritual content of what's going on. Nobody is providing support. Nobody is giving him a framework. No one has written a script for him to perform. He is alone, shaping his response to a God he can no longer hear as separate. Once again, to use the language I was using last night, it is as if the God who works outwards from the heart of reality is now working outwards from the heart of the human Jesus. There is no intervention from heaven. A point which the other Gospels bring out rather more explicitly when Jesus, for example, in Matthew says, "Don't you think that God could send 12 legions of angels if he wanted to?" But that's not how this works, which is a kind of note, you might say, to what seems to be going on in this chilling and strange narrative. Chilling and strange because you see it in glimpses without very much rationality to it. The midnight trial before the high priest and his advisers, not at all a legal procedure in Jewish law. A midnight trial which seems to make no sense, where people make senseless accusations that go unsubstantiated, and yet Jesus is still condemned. The exchange with Pilate, the incomprehensible choice of Barabbas. It makes no sense. It's a nightmare. We see it, you might say, from the perspective of the victim. If the victims of totalitarian violence and tyranny in our own age could tell their stories, and some, of course, have, they would sound very much like that. People who don't really know what's happening. They only know that everything is stacked against them, that they have no hope of getting out of this nightmare alive. It's the world captured, of course, memorably by Franz Kafka. Perhaps you understand Mark a little bit better if you know a little about Kafka's depiction of that kind of experience, of being locked into meaningless but completely irresistible power devoted to your destruction. We see the story from the victim's point of view. And that, again, is deeply significant for the whole of Mark's theology. You might contrast it with the way St. John tells the story of the Passion. There we see the high priest discussing the possibilities. We hear, wonderfully, Jesus' argument with Pilate, one of the great passages of the whole of Scripture. We have a sense of the inner dividedness of Pilate, but we have none of that in Mark. So isolation and the sense of arbitrary power closing in. And it's in the middle of all this that, as I mentioned last night, Jesus makes his one utterly unambiguous claim. Are you the Anointed One, the Son of the Blessed? I am, Jesus replies. And again, as I began to suggest yesterday, the placing of this claim, this breaking of the silence, is all important. When Jesus is stripped of all hope, of all power, when he stands alone in the middle of this meaningless nightmare, with no hope of life, then and only then does he say who he is. And he says it, of course, in terms of the divine name itself. God calls himself I Am when he speaks to Moses. And Mark, just like John, carefully places those words, I am, at a crucial moment. John scatters the I am sayings throughout his gospel. Mark, as always, much more economical and stark, boils it down to the one moment when you can be under no illusion about what faces Jesus. Then and then only does God declare himself. This man, this Son of Man, is the one who is enthroned with God. This is the one who will be the focus of the judgment of all things. You will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven, says Jesus. I've spared you a lengthy discussion of the phrase Son of Man, another of those endless scholarly squabbles. But at the very least, here as in several other places in Mark, it seems to mean this mortal being, this person here. I am, says Jesus, and you will see this mortal person. This mortal person alone and facing condemnation to death. This is the one you will see on the throne of God. This is the one who judges the world. And if my reading of the secrecy theme in Mark last night was correct, then the whole gospel is moving inexorably to this point. We've dismissed the idea that we should listen to Jesus because he does wonderful things, even that we should listen to Jesus because he says wonderful things. We listen to Jesus because every possibility of hope, of love, of absolution, it seems, has been swept away, and there is nothing left but this bare claim. This mortal person, says Jesus, stands here in the place of God. And the place of God is the place of a rejected and condemned human being. Before Jesus is arrested and condemned, you might still nurture the illusion as you read that it's all going to turn out all right. Perhaps he does have a future of human success. Perhaps we shall be able to find words for him in our usual language and vocabulary. But Mark makes quite sure that we cannot sustain any such illusion by this point. This is the event that is announced. This is the moment of regime change. This is where the world and the language we use is turned on its head. This is the gospel. And the new world, which is brought into being in this way, the new world which the Evangelion announces, is therefore one in which God cannot be dethroned by pain or disaster or failure. If the helpless, isolated Jesus says, "This mortal man is now where God is," then God's presence and resource, God's love and mercy, cannot be extinguished by loneliness, by injustice, by the terrible, apparently meaningless suffering in which human beings live. God has chosen to be at that lowest, weakest point of human experience. And so, the poor and the helpless, the condemned and the isolated, reading this story told from the victim's point of view, can know that God is with them, and that the God who is with them is not to be dethroned or defeated. I gave to this lecture the title "A Lifelong Passion," because connecting this with our theme last night, it's possible to see how everything that we've read so far in Mark's Gospel does indeed serve as an introduction to this world-changing insight. God is not where you thought he was. God is in and with this mortal man who is helpless, who is about to suffer a terrible death. And that's where God chooses to be and to declare himself. Reading back from that a couple of chapters, we may perhaps make a little better sense of the celebrated passage in chapter 10. Remember the dramatic story in chapter 10 of how immediately after Jesus has predicted his death, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, come to him asking for a special favor. They want to sit on Jesus' right and left in his kingdom. They are silenced by Jesus. The other disciples are angry that James and John have been seeking unfair advantages, and Jesus rounds on them as well, as if to say, "Well, if you'd haven't had enough gumption, you'd probably have asked me too." But the whole framework of seeking advantage is what I am here to overturn. "You know," he says, "those who are highly regarded among the nations lord it over them. Their officials exercise authority. And that is not how it shall be with you. Anyone among you who wants to be great must be your slave. If you want to be the first of all, you must be the slave of all. For this mortal person did not come to have slaves attending on him. He came to be a slave. He came to give his life as the price that bought back multitudes." That key passage, Mark 10, 42 to 45, is of course the foundation for generations of speculation about the meaning of the atonement. What does the redemption that Jesus offers actually mean? But in this whole context, it seems fairly clear. What Mark is saying, and what Mark is saying Jesus says, is this: the death of Jesus is the price that is paid to free us once and for all from the fantasy that God's power is just like ours, just a hugely inflated version of our own power. As I said yesterday, just an example of what we would do if we were lucky enough to be running the universe. The death of Jesus is the price paid to abolish and uproot that fantasy. It gets rid not only of the fantasy that God's power is like ours, but of course the other side of it, which is that our power is like God's, and therefore must be valued and clung to at all costs. In these errors, these lethal errors, lie the roots of all our sin and self-inflicted misery. In these errors lie the roots of death. From this, the death of Christ delivers us. His life is paid over so that we may be set free. It's not exactly a theory of the atonement. And as soon as people began to look through a microscope at this text, the difficulties began to arise. Who is the ransom paid to? Does God have to negotiate with somebody else in order to get the human race back? Does the devil have rights over us which God has to observe when he redeems us? And centuries of theological complication and sometimes frank theological muddle flow from this. I don't believe that Mark, or dare I say, Mark's Jesus, is very interested in theories of the atonement. Mark is telling us that Jesus uses the language of paying his life over to set us free, precisely in the context where he is saying what we have to be delivered from is a cruel and imprisoning fantasy about God's power and ours. Let go of all of that, and then there is freedom. That's the difference made by the crucified God, by the God who declares himself in the moment of isolation and helplessness. As we saw last night, thinking about the miracles, this is anything but an easy message to digest. And when we reflected a little last night on the very ending of the Gospel, we were reminded that that ending is deliberately, so it seems, deliberately inconclusive. You have to go back and start reading again, because there is no ending to conversion to this faith. Hardly have you put the Gospel down, Mark is saying to us, when you find some of those fantasies beginning to creep back in again. Well, go back and start again. It's not over. The event of Jesus' death has indeed, once and for all, exploded the fantasy. And yet, mysteriously, we behave as if we could still reinstate this terrible error that God's power and ours are the same kind of thing. We reinvent this day after day after day, and our conversion must happen day after day after day. The very first witnesses to the resurrection are terrified, and they can't find words in which to communicate what they've seen, because what they have seen is God setting his seal on the crucified Jesus. God declaring, once again, declaring himself in the dead, failed, abandoned Jesus. In the mysterious event of the empty tomb, God says, "That was not the end. I am alive in Jesus." To hear that for the first time, says St. Mark, was a terrible thing, a frightening thing. So, he says to us, don't be at all surprised if you find it terrible and frightening also. But of course there is, hidden in this, the extra little paradox. The women clearly did say something, because this gospel has been written. It did turn out to be possible to find words for what they thought they would never be able to talk about. So if you're stumped, baffled, dismayed, and silenced by the mystery of the cross and the resurrection, don't give up. Words were found. That's why this book is here, St. Mark says to us. Somebody found it possible to talk about this. So might you. But the somebody who found it possible to talk is reminding us again and again just how difficult it is. So that mysterious, miraculous ending of Mark, you might say, throws the ball firmly into our court. Yet again, we're drawn back to the centrality of the theme of relationship in Mark. The resurrection isn't just something you can point to. Oh, look, there's Jesus walking out of the tomb. Fancy that. It's not even Jesus returning in triumph to confront Caiaphas and Pontius Pilate and say, see, you were wrong. It's that mysterious recreating of a relationship of trust and love on the far side of the most extreme of suffering and dereliction and death. That is what the resurrection story points us to. So the gospel says, faith is possible in the crucified and risen Jesus. Relationship with the crucified and risen Jesus can happen. And there are words to be found if you will be patient and brave enough to wait for them. There are those who have thought that the end of the gospel is either an accident or, rather like the messianic secret, a kind of stratagem. There are those who say that because the story of the apparitions was created later than the first generation, somebody has to explain why nobody talked about the empty tomb. I think that's a preposterous theory myself, and one which makes Mark infinitely more mechanical and spiritually and intellectually second-rate than I think he can possibly be. What is, to my mind, most persuasive about this strange ending is exactly the oddity of it, the unexpectedness of it. And here, as in Matthew and Luke, and John for that matter, it is just worth remembering that while the rest of the gospel uses allusions and prophecies from Jewish scripture to make sense of what's going on, there are no Old Testament allusions in any of the resurrection stories. It was new enough and strange enough and worrying enough not to have any ready-made structure for it. In spite of the allusions in Jesus' own preaching, it still comes as a surprise. Equally, I find it a rather boring option to think that it's just an accident that somebody lost the last page of St. Mark, that there was only one copy and nobody ever picked it up, that Mark left the last page in the train between Capernaum and Jerusalem and it was never rediscovered. Or in the immortal words of the great Austin Farrow, one of the great New Testament scholars of the last century, are we to suppose that as Mark wrote the words of Chapter 16, verse 8, a heavy hand fell on his shoulder, and a voice said, "What's all this, my lad? I'll have to ask you to come along with me to the praetorium." So I think that's a dull and uninspired approach to a gospel which all the way through has been preparing us to be surprised. If the ending had been any more conventional, it might have been rather disappointing. So, once again, as we were thinking last night, the gospel warns us. It's not going to be easy, because when the first announcement of the truth was made, the witnesses couldn't cope. As with the apostles throughout the gospel, your own bewilderment and incomprehension as a reader is signaled in advance. Don't be surprised if this is difficult. It always was. This is a book that tells you, here is a book that's hard to read. Give it the time it needs. It may be short. It may be short on detail. But it takes as long as it takes to read, because you won't ever have finished it. There is no neat ending, and you must go and rediscover the possibilities of trust and faith in the helpless, the powerless God over and over again. And in that process, you will find that what Jesus speaks of in chapter 10, the absolute centrality of service, of self-gift, that is what begins to come alive in your reading and your responding. I mentioned briefly the way that Mark uses allusions to the Old Testament. He quotes Isaiah a great deal. He also quotes the Psalms quite a bit, and there are scattered references to the Law of Moses and one or two of the other prophets. Here, as in the other Gospels, but rather less so than in St. Matthew, for example, I think that that is saying, when you've grasped the revolutionary strangeness of what's going on in Jesus, you may also have a moment of realizing, but of course, if we had only known how to read the whole history of God's work in creation and in his relation with Israel, if only we'd been able to read that properly, then we'd have seen this was natural. And it's just that theme which St. Luke, of course, spells out for us in his story of the Emmaus Road, when Jesus says to the disciples on the road, "Fools and slow of heart, did you not see that it was necessary that this should be the way it was?" Mark is already preparing us for that kind of realization. Now we look back on the whole range of God's work, and we see that after all, yes, this was to be expected, if we'd only known. But God, the God of Jesus, is, after all, the same God who has been at work throughout. It's the very typical double vision of the New Testament. Nothing could have prepared you for what was going on in the death of Jesus, and everything should have prepared you for what was going on in the death of Jesus. So, drawing all this together a little bit, what emerges, I believe, is a sense that St. Mark's Gospel is a book about how Jesus, the reality of Jesus in his history, and the continuing reality of Jesus in his community, how Jesus takes you all the time in and out of silence, in and out of language, how you see, you grasp, and you then have to let go, how you think you might have mastered it, and suddenly find you haven't, and you must be quiet and listen again. It's a book about faith, about that fundamental aspect of faith, which is trustful letting go into a love that is completely surprising and works completely by its own rules, not yours. And that perhaps is why it's appropriate to think of Mark, whether he was the first of the evangelists or not, to think of Mark as, in some real sense, the beginning of the gospel, the arche, the first principle of the gospel, where the distinctive colouring of Christian faith is defined. Of course, Mark doesn't say everything. The most closely related Gospels, Matthew and Luke, have vital things to say about Jesus and about us. Matthew has the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew has the powerful stress on continuity, the climax of all God's work in the history of Israel. Matthew spells out the story of Jesus as both the natural culmination of all God's work, as we've seen, and a new phase, a new perspective. Very like Mark, except that he does it through the words, through the teaching of Jesus, rather than simply in the stark emphasis on the lonely dereliction of Jesus in Mark. Matthew is more of a historian, in the sense that his narrative has a beginning and an end, and a touch of order within it. Luke has the parables, the great parables of the prodigal son and the good Samaritan. Luke has the most warming and appealing portrait of a Jesus whose embrace for the outcast and the forgotten is quite simply the center of his compelling authority. Luke spells out the inversion of the world's values that Mark has already alerted us to in terms of that embrace of the stranger, the foreigner, the failure. And he does it again, like Matthew, with an elegant narrative structure. Yet Mark is in some ways the bedrock of the whole thing. And strangely, in many respects, he's more like St. John than he's like Matthew or Luke. Like John, he returns us to mystery. Like John, he has at the center of his narrative this great and mysterious declaration, I am. Like John, he ends with a teasing, almost inconclusive moment. In John's case, you remember, the evangelist ends by saying, I've written what I think you need in order to believe. If I tried to write everything that happened, it would be impossible. The world couldn't cope. And that's very like Mark. So unless we grasp Mark's silence and bewilderment, there's something we shall miss about the whole revolution in values and visions that's going on. We'll miss the radical depth of the new world. Not the whole gospel, but the beginning of the gospel, the foundation of something. Not, as I said on the first evening, not a naive work. Not Mark gathering in a disorganized way lots of community traditions and threading them together. Not an edifying work. Not a work that's simply meant to teach us good behavior and give us uplifting thoughts. But always on every page, a call to that metanoia, that repentance or change of mind, which Jesus demands in the very first chapter. And one last, perhaps fanciful thought. I spoke on Monday about the ancient tradition that Peter stands behind the writing of the Gospel of Mark. As I said on Monday, I think there is perhaps more to be said for this than some recent generations of scholars have allowed. But there is surely a deeper level at which Peter really is the central figure in terms of the hearers and followers of Jesus. The Peter of St. Mark is not a prince of the apostles, sovereignly getting right answers time and again. Peter is the typical hearer of Jesus, the typical witness, the one who most unequivocally gets it wrong again and again, and gets it wrong tragically and horribly, right at the moment when God is declaring himself. While Jesus is saying, "I am," Peter is saying, "I am not," a few yards away. Peter is the apostles, the witnesses, the church. Peter is us, brought to nothing by Jesus, called afresh out of his own chaos. Perhaps it really is, after all, the Gospel of Peter. And if it is the Gospel of Peter, be sure it's the Gospel for us. We have, again, about 15 minutes for some questions. Oh, right at the back. You know, I was wondering if somebody would ask me that. Readers of Mark will remember that curious scene in the Garden of Gethsemane when, as Jesus is arrested, a young man with nothing but a linen cloth around his body follows, or attempts to follow, is seized in the struggle, runs off, leaving the linen cloth behind, runs off naked into the darkness. Well, lots of theories. One, of course, is that this is St. Mark, that rather like Alfred Hitchcock, putting in an appearance in all his films, this is the evangelist, as it were, flagging up to those who know that he was there. That's possible, but I've never found it completely convincing, if I'm honest. There are other theories. Dennis Nynan, in his great 60s commentary on Mark, says that it's a symbolic event which alludes to the text in the prophet Amos, "Those who are strong in heart shall flee away naked in that day." But I don't quite see why strong in heart should have anything to do with it. I have a pet theory myself, which has absolutely no authority behind it except that, you know, you never know, that Mark is giving us a very, very sidelong allusion here to the story of Joseph, when the wife of the captain of the guard attempts to seduce him and he runs off, leaving his garments in her hand. Joseph, who was seen by many early Christians as a forerunner of Jesus, betrayed and sold into slavery by his brethren. And, of course, at this juncture in the Joseph story, thrown into prison under threat of death. But that's a long shot, to be honest. It's just a thought. Frank Kermode, the literary critic, wrote a whole book around some of these themes and said, well, you know, one of the things about imaginative writing, he doesn't mean simply made-up stuff, but imaginative writing, is that there will always be these details that you're never going to know the inside of. It gives a kind of extra dimension to the story. And it may just be that that's what it is. It may be quite simply that Peter or Mark or whoever remembered that there were people hanging around in the shadows that evening in Gethsemane, and one of them was too nosy for his own good and narrowly escaped a beating from the soldiers. Maybe it's as simple as that. But I think it's perhaps best to think of it just as one of those details that simply tells us, well, we're never going to know the whole truth. The other little detail worth mentioning there is that, of course, the young man wearing a linen robe is the young man who appears to tell the women at the tomb that Jesus is risen. And what you make of that, I don't know. But it's certainly an echo, such as Mark likes to give us from time to time. Another bit of mysteriousness. And I'd rather leave it there, I think, than just think it's the Hitchcock stuff. Thank you very much. That goes very much to the heart of the entire business, I think. I think that Mark, perhaps more than any other of the New Testament books, is a story of the death of God in the sense that what we most readily and instinctively reach for when we talk about God is going to be not only less than the truth, but almost hostile to the truth. The great French philosopher of the last century, Simone Weil, said once in one of her most infuriating paradoxes, "Any God that I can talk about easily must be the wrong one." And Mark seems to be pushing a bit in that direction. And as I've been saying, trying to tell us, it's never going to be glib. And that mysterious detail in Mark 15, that as Jesus cries out inarticulately from the cross and dies, the curtain of the temple is torn in two, that's commonly been taken, I think, as meaning that cry from the cross, that, again, declaration in inarticulacy in death. That is what tears open the barriers between earth and heaven. In the temple, the curtain which was hung in front of the Holy of Holies was seen as an image. We know this from a lot of Jewish literature. It was seen as an image of, if you like, the barrier between earth and heaven, the firmament draped between this realm and the realm of the divine. And that's taken away. God is no longer to be thought of in any sense at a distance, and that's where I go back to my favourite image of the God who works outwards from the heart of things. So, I don't think I'm being very good at articulating things either, but that theme of the death of God, in some sense, is at work here, and it is, to my mind, very much in tune with a great deal of what Christian mystics have wanted to say about the falling away of our images of God in the face of what's there. It's why Luther, you know, the last of the great medieval mystics, as he's sometimes been called, why Luther focused on the cross in his theology, so as to say, anything we think we can come up with, or any way we think we can have of persuading God to love us, is utter nonsense. God is what God is, and his love is his freedom, and not compelled by us. And so it's when we lose any confidence in what we can produce, either in our acts or our thoughts, that's when grace sets in. Sorry, lots more we could say, but a bit of a response. Yes, just next to you. Not at all. Quite the contrary. I think that's very important. And I think the allusion to the rabbinical tradition is extremely on the ball here. Jewish theology and philosophy, as most of us will recognize, doesn't happen on the whole in abstract treatises. It happens in narrative. It happens in argument, stories about argument, and sometimes unresolved argument. It sort of draws you in. And when the rabbis have had their say, it's almost as if the text of the Talmud or whatever turns to you and says, so what about you? What have you got to say about this? And there's a real element of that in Mark. As there is, to skip forward a few centuries, in the sayings of the Desert Fathers, where again, nobody is proving points, but everybody is saying, what about you? And certainly, Mark wants to leave us with that. Anyone else? Somebody here, and there's somebody right at the back there. So let's just take those two. Elaine?
Thank you.
thank you. That's very interesting. Very. I think I need quite a long time to try and answer it. Let me have a go. I'd certainly say it's part of God's respect for what God has made that's entailed here. God doesn't impose even healing on us. Jesus asks, do you want this? What are you after? And out of that encounter between the resource of God in Jesus and the, you might say, the unfulfilled image of God in the sufferer, out of those two things coming together, the spark flies and something changes. And I think that that does help us, as you so very well put it, in thinking about how our own compassion and anger in connection with the world works. Anger is traditionally seen, of course, as one of the bad habits of the self in the ascetical tradition. But it's also very interesting to see how, in the Greek Fathers, for instance, anger can have a good press as well. Anger can actually stir you up to see what's wrong. Sometimes you need anger to show you the incongruity between what is and what should be. So, I think the Greek Fathers would say, pay attention to your anger. What's it telling you? Sometimes it's just telling you you feel awful and your ego has been trampled on. Okay, deal with it. Sometimes it tells you there's something not fitting between God's purpose and the way things are. Right, pray with it. So I think that you're quite right. It does open some doors there. Thank you. And I think the last one, if that's all right, out at the back. Sorry, I didn't quite get all of that.
Sorry, I'll repeat that. The grace of Jesus and the church of influence shall be from today, and the church of God will be done by violence.
The influence of the church, the way in which the church can draw us away from violence as a society, as a globe. The church isn't there, I think, to come up with detailed peace plans here, there, and everywhere, though it can play its role in that. But I think the church does its best work when it asks the fundamental, the underlying questions. How did we get here? What have we been after? What was really going on? And, looking at the history of the last few years, looking at the tragic and disastrous conflict in Iraq, looking at a variety of other settings, I think the essential Christian question is still, what was going on? And I don't mean what revelations will the Chilcot Inquiry come out with, but what are the passions and the prejudices and the desires that are at work? How far are our decisions about that or about other matters informed by the wrong kind of anger, let's say? That is, the desire to be seen to be making a difference because we feel frustrated and impotent. The desire to seem strong. How far are we protecting ourselves against strangers that we can't cope with? We see that in the constant to-ing and fro-ing about the debate in public about migrants and so on. What are we afraid of? What are we angry about? And, that's a long job. And these are not always very welcome questions in an age when people would like to have solutions and sometimes say they would like the church to tell them what to do. And, of course, when the church does tell them what to do, they don't like it at all. But I think the distinctive thing that we as Christians have to bring to bear always has to be digging deeper. What's this coming from? What's the anger? What's the pride? What's the vanity? What's the greed that's at work? Doing some diagnosis, some moral and spiritual diagnosis, and laying bare a few things. I think think that's perhaps the heart of it. Thank you. I think probably we need a couple of moments now to get ready for our prayers. Thank you all very much for being here, and God bless you in the next few days.